People upload hundreds of thousands of videos and pictures to social media sites every day, and as those platforms have grown, so has the need for people to regulate what's getting submitted. Those people, known as content moderators, are tasked with taking down things like graphic violence and sexual material before they reach our screens. Our next guest took a deep dive into how that process works and how it shapes what we see online. Sarah Roberts is an assistant professor of information studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. She was born and raised here in Wisconsin. Her new book is called Behind the Screen, Content Moderation in the Shadows of Social Media. She talked to Central Time producer Dean Kinetter earlier today.
Why did content moderation strike you as something really important and worth traveling the world to research?
I think when I first became aware of this practice, which was almost 10 years ago now, I myself had been on the internet at that point for almost 20 years. I had also worked in technology, and I was doing a PhD in the area. And the fact that I had never heard of the practice, its total absence in any conversation to which I'd ever been a party, it led me to think that that it was actually being hidden. So that fact, coupled with the fact that I realized that the decisions that people were making around content moderation were influencing what all of us see and interact with online, led me to think that it had to be an incredibly important practice.
And people do this kind of work in a variety of settings, but generally speaking, what is a normal day like? How do they go about screening all of this content?
For the human kind of frontline content moderators who are working on behalf of social media, it's usually a full day consecrated to reviewing material that has been submitted in a variety of ways. When I first started my research, that material was being reported to those moderators mostly, almost exclusively, by other users, by people like you and me. What's really changed now is that we have algorithms and other kinds of computational tools that can go out and proactively scoop up a bunch of material too. What that's done is just increase the workload. So for people who are screening the content, not only are they looking at material that may have been flagged as bad or abusive by humans, but they're also looking for false positives that might be coming through via these computational means. And typically, they are sitting in front of screens, often for 8 hours a day, reviewing piece after piece of potentially bad content. Sometimes that material is innocuous. It's, again, it's a false positive. It's a cat video, or it's from someone's wedding. But other times, it can be punctuated by some of the worst material that a person could imagine or see. And in essence, there's often really no way to predict when someone will see one or the other. And that's one of the things that makes the job hard.
And you talked with people who do this work on a daily basis. A lot of awful stuff that they come across. What kind of emotional toll did that seem to take on them?
A lot of the workers that I spoke to, they were reluctant to go into detail about any psychological impact that they may have been feeling off the bat. And that was because, as you can imagine, it's a precondition of the job to not be adversely affected by the work that you're doing. But invariably, when we would get into conversations, things would come out. They would say things to me like, you know, since I've taken this job, I found myself drinking a lot more than I used to. Or I really kind of decline a lot of social invitations that I get because when my friends want to go out and hang out, we always talk about work, and I just don't want to tell people anything about what I'm doing. It even went to the point where one young man working in San Francisco described a situation where he was sitting with his partner on the couch, and they were kind of in an amorous moment and getting intimate, and he suddenly just pushed her away, and he said, I didn't even want to tell her why because an image flashed in front of my eyes of something I'd seen on the job. So these impacts, sometimes they're these small moments, but you can imagine that those add up and tend to aggregate. And for me, the most worrisome thing is that we don't have any longitudinal studies or information about you know, where will these people be in 2, 5, 10 years after they've left this workforce and they've sort of blended back into the social fabric?
You mentioned that this is, at the moment, largely an invisible job. Do we have a sense of how big this workforce is?
I like to be conservative in my estimates around that, but I think we're easily to the point where we're looking at six figures. If we even just look at some of the largest platforms that have been in the recent past more open about the numbers that they have, and that would be Facebook, Google's various properties, and so on, we know that those two firms alone are easily in the tens of thousands of workers. And that's just two platforms out of numerous platforms. So we're looking at a very large, a pretty significant, sizable global workforce that's engaged at some level in this work.
We're talking with Sarah Roberts right now, assistant professor of information studies at UCLA and the author of the new book, Behind the Screen, exploring the job of moderating the content that gets uploaded to the internet. And Sarah, sites like Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter reach people all over the world, places that might have really different cultural values and laws. Did that make content moderation more of a challenge for the people you talked with?
It's absolutely a big part of the challenge in the fabric of the content moderation kind of sub-industry. And this is one of the reasons why this practice has become globalized. The companies that require this moderation, as you point out, they endeavor to be global. They want the biggest audience possible. They want the whole world. And last I read the statistic about Facebook's user base alone, it's something like 87% of their user base is outside of the United States. So that suggests that in order to be effective with content moderation in these contexts, you need people who are linguistically, culturally, and also even legally oriented towards their locale for which they are moderating. So the companies have rushed to build centers to do content moderation in these particular areas. Germany is one great example. But that's not the only reason that we see this as a global workforce. You know, getting that linguistic and cultural competency is very important for sure. But the other reason is because of a desire to kind of chase the bottom line, the lowest labor cost. And that also has meant outsourcing to places like India and the Philippines, for example.
And I imagine content that might be considered offensive in one location might not be considered as offensive in another.
That's right. And so the moderators themselves are often called on as a, again, as sort of a base function of the job they do to set aside their own cultural and national identities and embody, if you will, a set of norms that come from elsewhere, often from the United States, but not solely, and that are intended for an audience that may be, again, in another part of the world. So it's a very challenging sort of work that requires a cultural and linguistic shape-shifting, and it can often yield discomfort for the moderators. They have to follow a very strict set of rules that are developed by the platforms that they then enact, and that could be really antithetical to their own orientation to the world, but that's what the job demands.
And you note in the book that for these big social media sites, content moderation is ultimately about preserving the brand and making money. How do you see that profit motive kind of shaping the decisions about what gets allowed on the platforms?
So the profit motive, of course, is fundamental to understanding commercial content moderation. And it's fundamental really to understanding social media as a whole. And that one of the goals of the book was to try to underline this fact for readers, because I think what we need is to get to a more sophisticated understanding of what the motive is for these social media platforms to exist. I don't think that users are particularly dumb or ignorant. I count myself among them, and I don't think of myself as in that way. But I think what is actually the case is that these firms offered a very alluring opportunity to the world, which was, in fact, this used to be YouTube's tagline, broadcast yourself, express yourself, share yourself with everyone else. Upload, circulate, look at other people's material. It's exciting and it's enjoyable. But the sort of profit side of that wasn't really fully unpacked and explored. And really what these companies are advertising firms. Our user-generated content is the thing that brings people to the platform, and it brings them back. It brings our eyeballs to the platform. And so that profit motive is really at the root of generating this practice of commercial content moderation. And it's the reason I argue in large part that it was kept so secret, because the firms wanted to keep their discretion about not only what to delete, but what to keep up. And those decisions were often made in terms of monetary sort of evaluations.
We'll have to leave it there. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be in Wisconsin.
That was Sarah Roberts, Assistant Professor of Information Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. She talked to Dean Kinetter, Central Time producer, earlier today about her new book. It's called Behind the Screen, Content Moderation in the Shadows of Social Media. If you have had the rare opportunity to do a job like this, if you've been a content moderator, we'd love to hear your story. You can email us ideas@wpr.org.